Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to this week's Risky Business Netcast. On today's show, we'll hear from Australian Federal Police Agent Nigel Fair. He's written a book all about cybercrime, and he'll be along to talk about law enforcement challenges in the digital age. We'll also run part two of our sponsored interview with Brian Sarton. He'll be along to discuss anti-forensics. But first, it's time for this week's news headlines with ZDNet Australia. Now, normally Munir Katadia fills this slot, but he's not along for this week for the same reason I'm sounding a bit dusty. We were both at Byron Bay's Splendour in the Grass Festival over the weekend. Munir is indisposed, so I'm doing the news on my own this week, and a busy week it's been. So on that note, ZDNet has reported ISPs could kill a new worm that is spreading rapidly via MSN Messenger. The worm, backdoor.ircbot.gen, spreads by sending file transfer requests to a victim's contact list. Once accepted, a malicious file is executed on the recipient's computer, which gives criminals control of the infected computer. Now, ZDNet has quoted James Turner, a security consultant for Australian-based research firm IBRS, claiming ISPs could stop the worm if they tried. Now, he said, "We've got the capability to block this attack at the network level." In other news, Telstra's Phil Burgess, the company's group manager for communications and public affairs, played the national security card last week, insisting the Optus-led G9 consortium could represent a national security risk if it wins the race to build us a national fibre optic network. Now, Burgess made this claim because Optus is majority owned by Temasek Holdings, the investment arm of the Singaporean government. And he said, "Why would you want someone outside your country to control your telecommunications?" And this is what he told reporters after speaking at a Rotary Club function in Melbourne. He described internet infrastructure as the nerve centre of the country, and Burgess said the ownership issue goes right to the heart of national security. Apple has plugged several serious security issues in its Mac platform and also fixed some problems in the iPhone. Dozens of vulnerabilities and bugs were covered by a total of 6 downloads for Mac OS 10.3.9, which is Panther, Mac OS 10.4.10, which is Tiger on PowerPC, and the universal version of Mac OS 10.4.10, as well as the server versions of each of those operating systems. Each download contains several patches to correct flaws, and Apple is recommending that all users of those operating systems download the updates. In social networking developments, a multi-hour outage on the popular social networking site Facebook caused a fault with the site that lets some users view others' personal site mail. But it was not a hack, say Facebook management. The company explained the problem as relating to errors with third-party proxy servers. A London-based IBM employee, Matt Dibb, reported on his blog that Facebook had been displaying strange signs shortly before it went down, replacing his login details with unfamiliar email addresses, which led him to theorize that the social network may have been hacked. Once the outage had been resolved, Facebook representatives released a statement claiming the bug caused some third-party proxy servers to cache otherwise inaccessible content. The result was that an isolated group of users could see some pages that were not intended for them. And that's it for this week's news. It's time to move on to this week's feature interview. Our guest this week is Nigel Fair. He's an 18-year veteran of the Australian Federal Police. He's worked in drug enforcement, counter-terrorism, and more recently in cybercrime. Nigel has also written a book called Cybercrime, The Reality of the Threat. In fact, if you grab a copy of today's Sydney Morning Herald or Age newspapers in Sydney or Melbourne, you can read an excerpt from it. He spoke to me by phone from Canberra last week about his new book and about law enforcement in the digital age.
I wrote the book, Patrick, to basically get some of my ideas of the broader cybercrime environment out in the public domain. The focus of the book was to get people that really don't have much knowledge in this space to become more skilled in how they operate in the online environment. Definitely not a technologist per se, but often I find your chief security officers and a lot of those people with a C in front of their title don't know that much about technology anyway.
Yeah. So it's really designed to bring people up to speed with the latest crime trends in general.
It's about the, as I said, the cybercrime environment and how it impacts society as a general.
Now, if I were to pick up this book right now and flip through it, what would I find the most surprising chapter or surprising themes to emerge out of that book?
The themes I don't think are particularly revelationary. Really, what it is, it's the consistent ones of end-user compromise, is just the real biggie. The fact that people get online and behave in a different manner than they do in the offline environment and pay the price accordingly.
I think there's a theory called the greater internet awkward theory, which goes something like you take a normal person, give them an anonymity and an audience, and all of a sudden they become complete awkwards. Is that something that you're saying applies to criminal types as well? Would you say that people are more likely to engage in criminal activity on the internet because of the anonymity that it affords them?
Well, people definitely behave in a different way, and criminal activity is just one of the things that they do online as well as many other things. But I suppose the real issue is they become victim to criminal activity, which in the real world they wouldn't become victim to.
From a law enforcement perspective, do you think authorities are on top of this threat, or do you think it's actually getting quite worse?
I wouldn't say it's getting worse, but it's really difficult to get on top of such a dynamic threat. From a law enforcement perspective, your police at all levels have got a wide range of issues confronting them, and technology is just one of them. One issue is obviously investigating cybercrime itself. The other issue is how technology relates to all other crimes. And investigators across the complete divide really need to understand how technology works, and their avenues of inquiry may include the internet or some sort of digital device.
Now, I understand too that pulling together a prosecution brief to charge someone with an offence committed over the internet, that's really quite challenging, isn't it?
Well, essentially, you're trying to prosecute someone or something on something that's completely borderless. The internet is obviously a complete borderless world, yet you're using state jurisdiction and state legislation to do that. Now, there's some mechanisms like extradition and mutual legal assistance, but they're very cumbersome and slow and really not geared up for this type of environment.
And it's also quite difficult to find evidence that's real smoking gun stuff, isn't it? Because log data can be modified. I mean, a lot of log data is going to be circumstantial. It's not really going to help you in court, is it?
Well, log data is just one sort of piece of a very big pie, and a lot of people think because they've got log data that and do a quick who is check that they've sort of got the person, when, you know, people, good criminals use proxy boxes all over the world, particularly in those jurisdictions where there's good fast broadband, and obviously they anonymize themselves and their activities, and so it's very difficult to locate these people, let alone find evidence of an offence.
Now, one of the trends that you outline in your book is concerns cybercrime originating out of Africa, which it doesn't seem to be a real hotbed for criminal activity at the moment, but you say it could be in the future. Can you explain why that is?
Well, there's been plenty of criminal activity generally come out of Africa in recent years, and from a technology and cyber perspective, I suppose you'd look at the use of the traditional 419 letters becoming online. Unfortunately, people still get suckered into those, and goes back to my earlier comment of people changing their behaviour. But they're building more internet connectivity in those regions, and the people are getting more savvy with technology, and there's some really good criminal minds over there that hide behind state barriers, and it'll be a good place to base yourself to do some serious cyber criminal activity in the future.
Now, also, we often hear that, you know, organised crime is very much involved in criminal activity conducted over the internet, in things like, you know, phishing and that type of fraud of that nature. Do these criminal organisations have, I suppose, tendrils? Do they have people on the ground within Australia, or is it purely a type of crime that's conducted from beyond our shores?
I think the important thing in answering that question is what you talk about with organised crime. I don't believe there's organised crime groups per se on the internet, and by that I mean your traditional hierarchical of groups that you might have had with mafia, people historically taking over the garbage collection in New York City, for example, or certain organised crime groups doing drug importations, and they control every part of it. What we're seeing with the internet and with crime per se on it is organised criminal networks as opposed to groups. And this is where you've got people forming an alliance to conduct an exploit, whether it be a zero-day attack or a phishing scam or something similar. And they get together, they pool their resources of skill and expertise, they'll buy in the products they need, whether they need a botnet or something like that. They'll do it, and then they'll go their own ways.
So it's not so much like a hierarchical organizational structure. You're looking more at a distributed organizational structure in these cases.
Absolutely. And the great thing is, because of the phenomenon of the net, they never need to meet. All they've got to do is distribute the money somehow, because that's what crime's all about. And they never need to meet, so they anonymize themselves at all steps, and it makes it obviously very difficult for law enforcement.
So let's talk a little bit about your experience with the Australian Federal Police. I believe you joined the Australian High Tech Crime Centre in early 2003. What have been the big cases, I suppose, that you've worked on there that you can discuss?
Well, probably the most recent decent-sized case is what we commonly term as Operation Proxima, and that's a male in Melbourne that got arrested and charged for using a botnet for a distributed denial of service. That's probably the most recent and the big one. We've done a number of smaller jobs, but I think the strength of the centre is really what they've sort of done in the background with regard to working with the private sector. Now, as you can imagine, most of the investigations that we do are not obviously for the public record until someone gets charged.
Mm.
But considering that we have a focus on critical infrastructure protection, and 90-odd percent of it in Australia is owned and or operated by the private sector, I think the big goals we've had have been our interaction with those and learning how they think, and thus them learning how we think, and particularly the banking and finance sector.
Well, it is interesting, because I understand the banks actually have fraud investigators stationed at the Australian High Tech Crime Centre, working directly in cooperation with sworn officers of the Australian Federal Police. Is this the first sort of instance you can think of where private sector investigators are working so closely with government law enforcement agents?
Yeah, absolutely. They've been there since May 2004. So worldwide, it was quite a pioneering move to get that happening. And they're completely integral to the centre. They're all they sit with the police. They're security cleared. They have access to the systems. They're treated exactly the same way as anyone else is there. And I think that's an important way of going to the banking and finance sector and saying, this is how interested we are in you and how seriously we take that. And obviously, they've shown the reciprocity by sending those people there.
And I suppose they not only have access to AFP information, but they also have access to the bank's information, and they can sort of act as a go-between. Is that right?
Absolutely. And you're able to see trends as they go with criminal activity and the networks behind it from bank to bank. One bit of identifying information from one bank might also equal a different piece from another bank, and it allows you to get a profile on a person or groups.
Prior to joining the AHTCC, I understand that you've done stints both in sort of narcotics investigations, like the importation of heroin and all sorts of bad stuff like that, dealing with your really nasty criminals, and also working in counterterrorism activities. Do you find that because a lot of these law enforcement officers who now work on high-tech crime came from more traditional AFP-type backgrounds, that there's a bit of a knowledge gap in terms of understanding the technology?
There is, but I believe it's easier for someone who is trained as an investigator to learn about technology and about the internet and technology-enabled crime than grabbing someone who's a pure technologist and teaching them to be an investigator.
So you think it really is a case that the skills, general skills as an investigator, are a little bit more difficult to acquire than the technological know-how, or at least the ability to understand the technology?
That's right, and what we need is people that are good investigators, people that can turn their mind to what has happened and look for different avenues of inquiry. We can always either buy in or bring the technology side by either training up police and intelligence officers, or by going out to the private sector or other government agencies that have that skill when it actually comes down to needing that grunt.
You're working on another book, is that right?
I'm actually interested in the concept of cyber ethics and how that relates particularly with e-commerce merchants and the ethical dilemmas that may seem normal in almost day-to-day commerce and commercial activities, but when you get in the online environment, does it really pass the, what if this got out in public test or if my mother was watching test?
Okay, well, Nigel Fair, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thanks for your time, Patrick.
AFP agent Nigel Fair there. In case you're wondering, these days Nigel heads up the AFP's Science and Technology Strategic Unit. You can buy his book, Cybercrime, The Reality of the Threat, on eBay and selected online bookstores for the bargain basement price of $34.95. We'll be right back after this.
Over 60% of information theft is now committed via lost or stolen computers. Can you measure the real cost of lost corporate data? Protect your invaluable assets with Checkpoint's PointSec Data Security. Find out more at checkpoint.com.
Now it's time for part two of our sponsor interview with Brian Sarton. Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust, sponsors this podcast. So each week we bring on one of its staffers to have a chat. It's the least we can do considering the company pays our bills. Now, for those of you who tuned into the program last week, you would have heard part one of this interview, which discussed forensics in cybercrime investigations. With more than 10 years practicing as a computer forensics examiner, Sarton now heads up Verizon Business Security Solutions' investigative response team. In this follow-up interview, I talked to Brian about anti-forensics tactics used by attackers to muddy the evidence trail. So last week, Brian, we were talking about anti-forensics and the challenges that it presents to people who work in a capacity as, you know, forensic examiners such as yourself. What are some of the tools that the bad guys are using to make your life difficult?
Oh, well, there's a variety of different types of tools and a variety of different types of names, but generally speaking, there are some basics that we're finding out there that these guys are using really to contaminate the crime scene and to prevent or at least limit our ability to pursue them from a prosecutorial perspective. There are things like, tools obviously to wipe data or overwrite it to such an extent that it's deleted but overwritten as if it never existed on the system. That's very frustrating, for instance, if you see in a log that an individual zip file or a RAR file, an archive, has been created and it's been downloaded off the system. Well, I can see that. I can see where it's downloaded to. I can see the size of it, but when I go to that place in the directory structure, even using forensics tools, there's no evidence that that file ever existed.
I suppose, what are they doing, random overwrites and things like that?
Well, even that, or they're using tools like BCP Wipe or Simple File Shredder, and we're even finding these tools on affected systems, but they're using those to overwrite only bits and pieces of what they've done.
Would you put that in the basket of anti-forensics, or would you just put that in the category of, you know, basic arse covering activity?
Well, I would say that the basic activities like that, I'd go so far as to call those anti-forensics. You know, I think there's a lot of other categories to throw in there as well.
What about throwing people, you know, red herrings? I mean, do you find people are deliberately planting misleading evidence to?
Oh, no question. I would say it's a one for one. When you find a taunt file that's been left behind by a hacker, in almost every circumstance, that's been deliberately left behind to mislead you.
Ignore it, you reckon?
Yes. Well, sometimes they're entertaining, there's no question, but it's worth reading.
Yeah, okay. So what
they'll
sort of stuff do they...
leave a taunt file, for instance, in Portuguese.
I'm sorry?
They might leave a taunt file in Portuguese when the actual perpetrators might have originated someplace in Turkey or in China, something like that.
Yeah.
And they'll attribute it to somebody whose name you can research on the internet, but who probably wasn't involved.
So they're deliberately leaving behind, you know, false clues, like a little card at a burglary saying Joe Bloggs did this.
Yes, yes. And things like that. Those have been out there for a long time and still become very popular these days. But you also see, you know, same thing that you've seen for a very long time is oftentimes the IP addresses. When we identify what the source is, unfortunately, it's rarely something as obvious as somebody's home DSL line or their cable modem line, and that's where the hacker is. It's always going to be
a proxy server in Uzbekistan or something like that.
Yeah, or proxy server, or even they go to one of these free web hosting type facilities. It might be something in Liechtenstein or something in France or something in South Korea, for instance.
Where they happen to offer shell access.
Yeah, and there's a simple Linux server that's running in a virtualization environment, and they've just basically taken over the server and they've registered it to an erroneous individual, or even used a stolen credit card to pay for it.
And then it is a matter of just tracing back through all of those systems and seeing, you know, you've got to trace it back to the last point, don't you? And it's touch and go.
Well, that becomes a difficult thing, is we can trace it back to that one location. Well, that might be in South Korea. But the actual person behind that might be in Florida, and they use that staging point in South Korea to get to a system in Australia.
So at what point do you just say this is too hard? Is it really a matter of cost? Have you been involved in investigations and forensic, you know, recovery type of activities where you've got to a point where you've said to the client, look, you know, we've tracked him back here, we've tracked them back here, but look, it's going to cost you, like, you know, another $400,000 to do this. Do you want to do it? And had them say, not really.
Well, yes, we do have to do that. Oftentimes you say, okay, you know, it took us 3 days to get to this point to have these findings. But in order to get something conclusive that we can provide to law enforcement, that's going to take maybe another 5 or 6 days. And they need to make the business decision on whether or not that's valuable enough to them. Mm. And then oftentimes law enforcement will get involved and say either you should or it's not necessary. And that's really, I think, the group, regardless of what country you're operating in, it's law enforcement who makes the decision over whether or not it's too difficult to pursue prosecution. Oftentimes extradition, costs involved, the number of cases and the caseload that they're dealing with at that given time, all factors into the situation. And it, there may not be enough damage or enough evidence to really pursue the situation. That's a difficult thing to see as a forensics investigator. But also that's a pain point that you see on the customers' faces, the people who experience the breaches.
Now, I've got to ask, what is the most advanced case of anti-forensics that you've personally come across? Was there someone who just was like a criminal mastermind, like someone who should have been a James Bond villain with a long-haired cat, you know, just evil genius stuff?
Well, advanced and clever, two very different things. The most clever are when they use very basic principles against us. Advanced, you know, obviously would be a different thing. Now, I'll give you two examples of clever ones.
Okay.
One was a large case that that we handled this past year that was in South America. The person who we suspected took the data was an internal employee, was actually an information security, he was an IT security manager. And he was using, very similar to steganography, he was taking data, transaction logs that he was able to get a hold of, and he was plugging them inside of pictures. Well, steganography has been out there. That's the most common tool out there.
Mm.
Now, what he did, though, similar to like the movie Basic Instinct, he decided while he was doing all this, and he was just emailing these pictures out, and they were just pictures of his friends, things he'd taken with his camera, only the pictures were unusual in size given the clarity of the picture.
Mm. And so they were sort of like a 16 by 16 GIF that weighed in at around 2 meg.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what he did is he decided to take it on himself and organize a large presentation for his entire team to tell them what all the leading anti-forensics tools are.
Okay.
At the same time, so the idea that a forensics investigator would say that this person used steganography to get data out when he had just given that presentation to his entire team seemed ridiculous to his team.
Yeah. So he was really playing some sort of evil genius mind games on his own crew.
Well, you take that and combine it with the fact that steganography up until, you know, just recently, it's been exceedingly difficult with some steganography type of tools to actually prove that a file's packed.
Yeah.
And actually extract the archive. Now,
well, you really need to know, you need to know how it's packed, don't you? I mean, there's a million different ways of stuffing data into a image file.
Yeah, absolutely. You stuff data into an image file, and that's encrypted. And oftentimes, you know, the data itself being encrypted with a password, even if it's a low encryption, when it's stuffed into an image file, you open that up with a forensics tool, well, the image and the data, you can't tell where that data payload starts and where the image stops. Another example, which I think is even more clever, this was a situation that I recently investigated myself. This individual worked for a vendor that sold a retailer, a very large retailer. Actually, they were a PCI level 1 retailer. They sold this retailer, had many hundreds of different store locations, sold them their point of sale system. And they also supported this point of sale system every day such that that retailer's people didn't even have administrative access. Well, we found there was evidence of identity fraud and customer complaints. Customers were coming in saying, you know, every day there would be 8-9 people saying, look, I've got a checking account. I've only written 3 checks off of it. They've been at your store. Now it's got fraud. What do I need to know?
Mm.
This organization retained us to conduct an investigation. And in this situation, looking at the data that was stolen, looking at the systems that handled that data, the breach had to occur at the individual stores with fraud. There were about 16 of them.
Mm.
And we sampled several of those locations, expecting that we'd find a pattern. Now, what we found, there was no hard evidence of security breach, but from the time that that data, the accounts with fraud belonging to these individuals, were written into these systems, this point-of-sale system, to the time that it showed up with fraud suddenly, well, only one or two people touched that data, and they were always this vendor.
Mm.
When we went and questioned the vendor about it, we found that the vendor had some 28 people or so in their support center. And they all used the same username and password, which, incidentally, let's say the software was Acme, The username was Acme and the password was Acme.
Nice.
And they used PC Anywhere over the internet to connect to it.
Yeah, great. Did they use Telnet as well and other such advanced security technologies?
You wouldn't be surprised, but no, in this case, they just used PC Anywhere with basic passwords. No firewalls or anything.
Okay.
And now here's where it got interesting. At that point, we didn't have enough to prove it on one individual, but it was obvious we could prove it with the vendor, but not enough to get law enforcement involvement. We set a basic trap on the system, and that trap, one of which would use the built-in PC Anywhere function to record the session like a movie each time someone logged on.
Mm.
Another one was a little homegrown scripting system we have that captures IP information on the system every minute or so and logs it to a hidden file. That particular script would send out an alphanumeric page when somebody connected. Well, all of a sudden, somebody connected. And here's what this individual
You guys have read The Cuckoo's Egg a couple of times, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay. Continue.
So here's my pager went off on a Saturday morning, and I connected to the system, and I went and looked at this output file, and I realized, wait a second, the output file's empty. All the entries from that morning were gone. For example, the one that had triggered the page. And I looked at the modification date of the file. The file was created when I created it. However, the last access date was a year ago.
Interesting.
Yeah. What is that about? So I realized that, we also have the PC Anywhere log. So I downloaded the movie, replayed the session so you can see everything that was happening on the screen. And what this individual did is he connected. He set the system clock date back 1 year. Went and found our file, and he evidently knew where this file was because he didn't have to search for it. And he used search and replace to find every instance of his IP address, and he would delete the line.
Nice.
So you could see the IP address.
Yep. So
it
you
was
got
obviously
him.
The vendor.
Yeah, okay.
Now, it turned out what he was doing is he was going in and setting a diagnostic utility on the system, and that would capture raw information like credit cards and checks that were routing through there as well as customer identity information, name and address. And he was logging that to a file and selling that data. Well, he would get in doing legitimate work, closing a trouble ticket, servicing a trouble ticket, and he would enable this setting. Then he would wait till the end of the day when around 7:30 when everybody would leave, and he would log on to his boss's PC, the support center manager, and he would use his boss's PC to get in there and to download those files that he took.
Meanwhile, the boss probably loved him because he, you know, always stayed back.
Uh-huh, always did fantastic work and stayed late, exactly. Mm. And he was using his boss's PC to steal this data to hide his identity and setting the system clock back such that we couldn't see modifications to the system like when he would enable this diagnostic utility. Real basics, but very effective.
You mentioned also last week that these semi-insiders, like vendors who are providing support to people, you're seeing a lot of activity there. Do you think organizations really need to have some sort of oversight to control the access that third parties, whether they be vendors or support companies, have into, you know, their systems that contain this sensitive information?
No question. I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. That's really where these breaches are starting to happen, and that seems to be the direction right now. And I think that if you could learn anything from the victims out there, it's make sure that anybody who has access to your sensitive data, whether they're one of your employees or a third party of some kind who has connectivity with you, make sure that they realize that Big Brother's watching and make sure you have accountability of that. And there should never be a structure where a third party of any kind can get access to your systems without, first, your express consent, and second, a one-time password, or at least some type of unique ID and a two-factor authentication structure.
Okay, well, Brian Sutton, thank you very much for your insights again this week.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for another edition of Risky Business. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast using the links to the left of the posts on the website. You can use iTunes or whatever podcatcher you prefer. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.